Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the horrid halls of academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
And ow, Andrea, stop it, ow! Witch! Your specter just keeps coming out and, like, pinching me.
Oh, right, yes.
Oh, no, she's a witch. We should probably burn you, or hang you, whichever.
Maybe a bit of both.
So if you haven't already guessed, as we promised last month, we are back for part two of our discussion of witches in film.
I was going to say, I don't think we've ever done a part two of an episode before, but I guess our assessment series, that's kind of different.
It is a bit different. So, you know, now we're getting a little cocky, so it's time to sequelize ourselves. And we did feel, and I think from your comments as well, we felt that there was just so much more to talk about with witches and their portrayal in film and the way they've been dealt with throughout history and in pop culture. So we felt it was a good time a year later to return to the scene of the crime and take another look at it.
That's right. And I listened to our last episode on witches just this afternoon to make sure that we didn't rehash anything, to make sure that we didn't go over the same stuff we went over last time. And what I discovered is I don't think we have to worry about that. The films that we chose for this episode deal with very different themes within witchcraft, which I think is actually really cool. I think it just goes to support the malleability of the figure of the witch and the different ways witches are used in different horror narratives.
Absolutely. I think with our first witches episode, we were looking at the internal struggle of the witch and the coming or resisting of power. And now we're really going to look at witchcraft in not only a more historical context, but also in the context of a larger society and a larger group of people having to deal with the accusations of witchcraft or with the power of a certain witch.
So we got a lot of really interesting suggestions from listeners of other witch movies that we could talk about, but we chose three that we felt strongly about. I'm actually proud to say that for the first time ever in this podcast, we picked three films that I had never seen before. So I saw all three of them strictly to prep for this podcast, so I think that's kind of neat. Now we're going to talk about these sequentially. We've decided to talk about them in the order, not that they were made, but in the order that their stories took place. Because as Alex just said, they all deal with witchcraft kind of historically, and so we felt like that was the best approach. We are going to start with an old British film, not a Hammer film, but we kind of wanted it to be a Hammer film. But if you watched it expecting a Hammer film, you were a bit disappointed and maybe a bit confused. I'm talking about the 1968 film directed by Michael Reeves, The Witchfinder General.
With the tranquility of rural England shattered by civil war, evil was spawned at a time of strife in the land.
Take him, Stern. Look for the devil's marks upon him. Right. Albert, you two.
Pounding the innocent in violence and terror, this evil man showed no mercy in the pursuit and interrogation of his victims. He was called the Witchfinder General. And amidst the horror of the witch hunt, a story of tender young love.
Didn't your uncle just say you must early to bed?
He did.
And isn't he a wise man?
He is.
But even their innocence is cruelly corrupted by the vile touch of the Witchfinder General.
My motive in coming here was to find the truth.
Vincent Price is the Witchfinder General. Lust and greed were his only gods.
The money from the magistrate. 9 guineas in silver.
Good. Now we can leave.
Ian Ogilvy as Richard Marshall. He stood alone against the forces of devilish destruction.
And 'tis in thy sight, O Lord, that I hereby swear I shall not rest from the pursuit of his murderers till they stand before thee, ready to answer to thee for their sins.
Rupert Davies as John Lowes.
Master Marshall, welcome.
Patrick Wymark as Oliver Cromwell.
Amongst the most pleasurable aspects of victory, gentlemen, is the opportunity it affords to reward valor. It ranks almost with good food.
And Wilfrid Bramble.
And what line of business might you be in?
God's business. Witch-finding.
Witch-finding. Oh, that's nice. That's very nice.
And introducing Hilary Dwyer as Sarah. Filmed in authentic detail and photographed with piercing realism against the actual background of peaceful villages and quiet countryside. Never has England looked so beautiful, yet been so violent.
I'm your man friend. John Stern, they call me.
Man's inhumanity to man portrayed on the screen so vividly that you flinch. So real that you too will fear the Witchfinder General.
Ah! Ah!
see it, be the first to talk about it. The Witchfinder General.
So this film starts out with a character named Richard Marshall, a young man who is out with his parliamentarian platoon. Now, this film takes place during the English Civil War. Now, he reveals that he's in love with a woman named Sarah, who lives in nearby Brandston, and so he rides to visit her as soon as he's on leave. Now, when he arrives, she lives with her Uncle John, who's also the village priest, and John tells Richard that the couple have his blessing to wed, but he really hopes that Richard will take her far away from the village because he senses that trouble is coming and he wants her to be safe. And Sarah confirms that they've become outcasts in the village and they've been threatened. Richard swears that no harm will come to them. They hook up because that's a really romantic thing to say. It's kind of aphrodisiac. And when Richard's leave is over, he goes to rejoin the army. And what's funny is he actually runs into Matthew Hopkins on his way out. Matthew Hopkins is the titular witchfinder, played by Vincent Price, and John Stern, his assistant. And as soon as he leaves, the pair descend on Sarah's home and start interrogating her uncle with the bullshit tests that are used to detect witches. You know, they're jabbing him in the back, looking for the devil's mark and whatnot. Now, Sarah offers Matthew some sexual services in exchange for her uncle's freedom, but Matthew is called away before he has time to do the deed. Now, with Matthew out of the way, his assistant actually rapes Sarah, and when Matthew returns, he decides that, hey, she's damaged goods. I don't actually really want to hit that anymore. And so we may as well just go ahead and torture and execute her uncle. So that happens. Now, when Richard returns, he's appropriately horrified, but he's a cool guy. He doesn't blame her or anything. He actually marries her right then and there, and he actually sends her away to another village where she'll be safe. Now, at this point, the film really meanders. A common criticism of this film is that it's slow, and I really feel like this is the point in the film where that's very much the case. There's a point where Matthew and Stern get separated, and Stern is attacked but escapes, and Richard gets into trouble with his military superiors, and none of this actually really matters in the end. I read some stuff that the director was trying to incorporate some Western themes into the film, which partially explains all this superfluous fighting and all this focus on horses, and where's the horses, and if you got the horses, it really doesn't matter. Anyway, Stern and Matthew arrive in the same village where Sarah is hiding out, and there's this ploy to kind of trap them, but they manage to figure out a way to accuse Richard and Sarah of witchcraft, so they take them to the tower for torture. They stab Sarah's back while Richard watches, shackled to the wall, but he manages to break free, and he straight up stamps Stern's face to death before he hacks into Matthew with an axe. Now, at the same time, some of his fellow troops burst into the room to rescue him, and they shoot Matthew before he's dead, which really upsets Richard, who shrieks that they ruined his revenge. You took him from me! And the film ends with Sarah screaming in utter madness.
I'm really glad we've come to this film now having done The Wicker Man, because in a lot of ways, The Witchfinder General is kind of a precursor to a lot of the themes that would emerge in Robin Hardy's The Wicker Man. It did come about at a time when Hammer horror films, which had been, you know, the big filmmaking boom in England through the 50s and 60s, was really dying out, and they were struggling to come up with new and original ideas. And some of their new and original ideas back in the early to mid-60s were to send Dracula to swinging London or have a kung fu version of Dracula. So they were trying to update it, but it wasn't really working. And then, as Andrea said, this isn't a Hammer film, but it does come on the heels of it, and what we see is a return to an English history and part of the English eerie, which I mentioned in the last podcast. And with this, The Wicker Man, several other films, we see the emergence of something called folk horror. And that was a really big proponent. And it's about taking horror and examining it through a historical lens. So obviously, you know, Matthew Hopkins existed. This was a real person. You can look him up. A lot of the tactics they used to interrogate witches were very violent and brutal. And we did talk about that in our first witches episode. So there is some truth to the goings-on in this film, but it was, of course, highly fictionalized to make it into a semi-cohesive story.
Now, the director, Michael Reeves, is famous for dying young. This film is lauded as a critical horror British classic, and Michael Reeves sadly didn't get to live to see most of the praise of this film. He died of an accidental drug overdose at age 25, and this was only 9 months after The Witchfinder General came out, which was his fourth film directing. He was lifelong friends with Ian Ogilvy, who played Richard Marshall in this film, and Ogilvy also had lead roles in his other films. And another famous factoid about this film and Michael Reeves is that he really did not get along with Vincent Price He had Donald Pleasance in mind for this role, and you would think that if you go from Donald Pleasance to Vincent fucking Price to horror theater royalty that he'd be so stoked, but he wasn't into it. He knew Vincent Price overplayed everything. He was very campy. He was very hammy. And apparently, throughout the entire filming, Michael Reeves was telling him to tone it down, tone it down, tone it down. So the two were always at each other's throats, but famously, Vincent Price looked back and said, "I didn't realize what he was going for, and now that I've seen it, I totally respect his methods, and I wish he could have communicated them better to me," but many agree that this is one of Vincent Price's most nuanced but also best roles in film.
Absolutely. And it's funny, having done this podcast for over 2 years now, where we examine horror films, and we haven't gotten to talk about Vincent Price yet, and he's such an iconic figure in this genre. But I'm so glad we're starting to talk about him with this film, because I agree, from all of the films I have seen of him, it's such a cruel performance. It's very cold. It's very dark. But there is this kind of light behind his eyes. There's something very charismatic about him. And I actually have a really hard time just even imagining Donald Pleasance in this role. So I'm so happy that Vincent Price came to appreciate the film on the level that he did, because he's incredible in it.
You made a mistake, my friend.
The film is extremely cold. It is extremely humorless in every respect. It begins with a woman screaming. It ends with a woman screaming. Gore-wise, it's difficult for some of us to look back on that day and call it a very gory film, but the film was actually entangled in several censorship battles that had it hacked up to bits. The version that I got to see was the director's cut, and so they allegedly put some of the scenes back in, and there was a little disclaimer that said, you know, the scenes we added back in might not look so good because they were kind of salvaged from the cutting room floor, and sure enough, it was just kind of an extended look at some of the axe hacking and some of the backstabbing, and they really didn't need to put it back in. But apparently Michael Reeves was pretty bent out of shape about the censorship cut, so I guess in his memory it's good to know that there's a director's cut out there that's got the whole thing.
One of the things I really like about this film, and just kind of as Andrea mentioned, is it's very nihilistic. It's very brutal. It's very unforgiving. And I love that from the first moment to just this almost tableau imagery shot of some random woman. She's been convicted of being a witch. She's taken out by the town, hung. Everyone looks at her body and leaves. I enjoy that they've made it very mundane, all this witch stuff. It was from the outset, you are so clear that everything that is happening is by rote. It is happening all over, to the point when Richard comes and joins Sarah in the other town that they go to, we actually see a woman being burned, and it is harrowing. It is harrowing to watch a body just being dumped into fire. And on the side, you have the man who's revealed to be her husband just screaming her name, Elizabeth.
Elizabeth!
So you have a sense that Richard and Sarah's story is not particularly special. It's happening all across England at this time. So we really have a sense of the loss of life that was happening and how cold and unrepentant so many people were about it.
It's true, but I also appreciated the fact that in all of the execution scenes, a lot of movies have a tendency to exaggerate the glee of the bystanders, these bloodthirsty bystanders who are watching and just chomping at the bit and pumping their fist and cheering, yeah, burn that bitch. Whereas these bystanders were pretty passive. It was just kind of like, oh, just another day, this is happening.
No, it's funny because there'd be a sense of excitement or people wanting to watch it, and then as soon as it happened, everyone just kind of went, huh. And, like, walked away.
Huh, she didn't fly away. Guess she wasn't a witch. Womp womp.
We have found the witch. May we burn her?
Burn her! Burn her!
How do you know she is a witch?
She looks like one!
Yeah, she looks like one!
And a lot of the idea in the English, Aryan, British folk horror is that oftentimes there is something kind of evil or wrong about the place. But like with the Wicker Man in The Witchfinder General, it's actually the people who are causing the evil and being unjust in their actions. So I like that it's really putting the onus on us to make amends or try to reconcile something we have done in the past.
Right. And I feel like that's very true of several of the films we're going to talk about today. In the last Witches episode, we talked about political motivations behind the witch trials, that the witch trials were an attempt to stamp out paganism and to repress women, and that it was a really concerted effort on the part of the church. Whereas I feel like in The Witchfinder General, we've got this character of Matthew Hopkins, who is not especially pious. He is definitely not a God-fearing man. He's actually quite evil. He readily accepts Sarah's offer of sexual favors in exchange for her uncle's life. He's in it for the money. He's in it for the sex. He's in it for the power. We never really get a clear idea that the church has even commissioned him or even really knows what he's doing. He's a lawyer. He's just appointed himself in the role, and he's trolling the countryside doing this and having a blast because he's getting off on the power. By contrast, his assistant, John Stern, is quite clearly a sadist. He's in it for the violence. So as such, this entire film is mostly about power and how characters like Matthew and Stern are already corrupted by power. We also see power corrupted in Richard, who is a good man who tries to do the right thing and tries to do well, but in the end becomes a sadistic mess.
Well, and one of the things I thought was so interesting about this film is it opens alongside that kind of tableau scene that I was describing with a voiceover basically explaining that Matthew Hopkins, he's the bad guy. He's not the good person. He's doing bad things to good people. So I thought it was really interesting that it situated the titular character as the antagonist rather than the protagonist. So as we're introduced to him, as Richard runs into him on his way into Braniston, we know bad shit's about to go down. We are expecting it. And we feel for them, and we feel that moment when Richard is like, hello, hello, oh, it's just down there.
How far is it to Braniston, friend?
About 3 miles.
Thank you.
Are you the lawyer?
Aye.
Name of Hopkins.
Aye, Matthew Hopkins, and this is my assistant, John Stern.
What do you want to know, soldier?
There's some men from the village back there waiting for you.
Aye, they sent for us.
What would a lawyer want in Braniston?
A man who may not be what he seems to be.
That he's leading this terrible person straight to his fiancée, essentially, the woman he loves. And we just have that, certainly I did as an audience member, my stomach just sinks. And I've seen this movie a few times, and it's that moment where you're just like, oh, I wish he'd just do something different this one time I watched it.
The year is 1645. England is in the grip of bloody civil war. On the one side stand the Royalist Party of King Charles. On the other, Cromwell's Parliamentary Party, the Roundheads. The structure of law and order has collapsed. Local magistrates indulge their individual whims. Justice and injustice are dispensed in more or less equal quantities and without opposition.
So another thing I read about this film is that, as I already mentioned, that this is a film that sees Richard and Sarah both demented and broken from their ordeal. Now, Richard was actually supposed to die in the script due to a gunshot wound. The soldiers were supposed to burst in and shoot one and then accidentally shoot the other, but it became a continuity error because they were using those flintlock pistols, which could only shoot once, and then you have to repack it and pack it down. I've actually shot one of those, and I was amazed as you have to drop in this little pot and then put in some gunpowder and then pack it down carefully but not too hard because God knows you don't want that to blow in your hand. Anyway, somebody actually noted, shit, we can't have two gunshots back to back with only one flintlock pistol. So it was a continuity error and Richard got to live instead. So I think what they did was they just made him go mad. Kind of the worst case scenario next to being dead.
It's such a strong and scary ending in that way when you just see the two people who you hoped would survive and make it through when they actually do. And the, was it Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Who will survive and what will be left of them? And all we see are these two just broken psyches of people who just tried to keep it together and then couldn't control their nature where they just lashed out, especially Richard, where he just hacks Matthew Hopkins to death.
Now, what's interesting about this film for our purposes, apart from the points that we've already brought up, there is absolutely not a single witch to be seen, either a pagan witch or a supernatural witch or even just a weird feminist. There is actually no one to blame for anything that's going on except for the witchfinder general. And it doesn't blame the church either. Matthew is acting on his own self-interest, and Stern is just in it for fun. So I feel like what this contributes to the conversation is just a really unapologetic, stark look at the back end of what we talked about in the first episode, which is why I'm really glad we're talking about it in this one.
So another factoid, to use an Andrea term.
Aw, that's not my term, is it?
I like to think it is.
How embarrassing.
So the alternate title in the U.S. when it was released was The Conqueror Worm. And this was used because Roger Corman's Edgar Allan Poe cycle had actually done quite well. And the alternate title of The Conqueror Worm is taken from a Poe poem. Now, this poem, as just a brief synopsis of that, is basically angels are watching a play by mimes who are chasing a phantom that they can never catch. And then finally, a creature emerges from the darkness and eats all of the mimes. So I like that they took a really metaphorical title, actually quite a deep title, and tied it to that thing of you're always chasing something. So, you know, you could read a lot of things into that. So Matthew Hopkins is chasing a phantom, or is it Richard who's chasing the phantom, who is Matthew Hopkins? But ultimately, the one certainty we all have in this life is that we will die. So no matter what that struggle is, no matter what that chase is, whatever that goal is, you can attain it, or you might never attain it, but it won't matter because we will all meet the same fate in the end.
So they scrapped that title because the story actually didn't have anything to do with anything Poe except for the metaphorical meaning that you just brought into it.
Yeah, and I mean, it's very much a part of the kind of marketing cycle that they were trying to hit on, but it never really caught on. As you kind of said, unless you know this American literature poem, it's not going to make a whole bunch of sense. So Witchfinder General makes a ton more sense. But I think that goes to speak to how hard it was to market something that wasn't Hammer, that wasn't established. This was quite new, especially in 68. So they were looking for things that the audience would be able to understand. So I like that they went kind of really deep with it. And I think it hints and illuminates a lot of that nihilistic quality of the film.
So moving on to a film that is ultimately at its base about corruption of humanity and about how the pursuit of power pretty much corrupts absolutely, whether you're the good guy or the bad guy, dovetails nicely into our next film that we're going to talk about, Arthur Miller's award-winning play adapted onto the screen by Arthur Miller, who wrote the screenplay, The Crucible.
Oh, John, give me a soft word.
Abby, I may think of you softly from time to time, but I will cut off my hand before I reach for you again. We never touched.
Hi. We did.
What some hearts desire, they must possess.
I know you, John Proctor. You love me. Whatever sin it is, you love me yet.
What they cannot possess, they must destroy.
I have a warrant for your wife.
For what crime?
And what proof? Who charged her?
Well, Abigail Williams charged her.
Abigail wants me dead, John. You know it.
This girl is false!
If you cry words against my wife, it will be the end of you.
I am but God's finger, John. If he would condemn Elizabeth, she would be condemned.
In a world ruled by fear,
Judge Hawthorne has condemned 14 more people to the jail and promised hanging if they don't confess.
Confess? To what?
All it takes to be condemned.
Anyone breathe a word, and I will come to you in the black of some terrible night, and I will bring with me a pointy reckoning that will shudder you.
Is to be accused.
I saw Bridget Bishop with the devil. I saw Penny Oliver with the devil.
Crazy children are jangling the keys of the kingdom and common vengeance rights. The law. I'm not giving my wife to vengeance.
I never dreamed any of this for you. I wanted you was all.
That is a whore, Mr. Danforth!
She thinks to dance with me on my wife's grave.
God help me, I lost it!
You will look at me only. In my eyes only.
Now, we shall touch the bottom of this swamp.
20th Century Fox proudly presents Arthur Miller's timeless tale of truth on trial.
Did you see Goody Proctor's spirit?
Never! Never!
Crucible.
I have given you my soul. Leave me my name!
Directed by Nicholas Heitner. Screenplay by Arthur Miller.
So the film The Crucible was made in 1996, and it was based upon a play by Arthur Miller, which he wrote in 1953. But Arthur Miller actually wrote the screenplay for this particular film adaptation. The movie is set in 1692 Salem, so everyone's pilgrimy looking and they're all black with lace collars and etc. Now, the film opens with the young girls of the village participating in what looks like a voodoo ceremony, hosted by Tituba, who is a black slave in the village. They're participating in the ceremony in the hopes of realizing their crushes. It's all very innocent. They're all naming the boys that they like in the village, except for this one girl, Abigail, who takes things a step further by biting the head off a chicken to hex a woman named Elizabeth Proctor. Now, the ceremony is interrupted by Abigail's uncle, the Reverend Paris, and when they realize that the Reverend is watching, all hell breaks loose, and at some point in the confusion, the Reverend's daughter, Betty, falls unconscious, and she won't wake up. She's not the only one to fall to this mysterious affliction in the village, so based on what the Reverend saw, he's obviously concerned that witchcraft is afoot, and so they call in Reverend John Hale, who is supposedly an expert. So as Reverend Hale examines Betty, Reverend Paris tells him what he saw in the woods, and suddenly Abigail and the girls become very afraid that they might be on the hook for witchcraft. So Abigail accuses Tituba of setting the whole thing up, and Tituba is subsequently questioned. She's whipped brutally such that she confesses, and she confesses such a heartfelt indictment of the whole entire village. It's actually one of the more heart-wrenching parts of the entire film, I'd say. Anyway, with Tituba confessing to bringing witchcraft to the village, the girls continue the charade with increasing dramatics, naming other women they claim to have seen with the devil. And they pick really easy targets. They pick this woman who's so outspoken and is just like, fuck you all. They pick a woman who's kind of part crazy and kind of witchy looking, so she's an easy target. But they also accuse Elizabeth Proctor again. By now, it's been revealed that Abigail used to work in Elizabeth Proctor's home and had an affair with her husband, John Proctor. Elizabeth became aware of the affair and fired Abigail, and the issue is still a big point of contention within their marriage. John basically blames her for never having forgiven him, and she blames him for having ever done it, saying, you know, something like that isn't something we can just shrug off. She is in love with you, and that's something she's going to carry with her forever. So John is adamant that Elizabeth not be tried in these bullshit proceedings, so he comes forward with their current employee, a young girl named Mary, and accuses the girls of bearing false witness. He admits to the whole affair with Abigail, but when they bring Elizabeth in to confirm the fact, she actually lies to save her husband's life, which ruins the whole thing. Mary then turns on John and Elizabeth out of fear of Abigail, and John is accused of turning away from God, to which he replies despairingly, "I say God is dead." So John and Elizabeth join the ranks of the accused, along with a whole bunch of people. The law is brought in the form of Judge Danforth, who wants to get to the truth on the one hand, but he also feels a certain pressure to punish someone, anyone, for the disturbances going on at Salem. His good name is at stake, and the witch-punishing industry has to go on, so he can't go back empty-handed. Unfortunately for him, the villagers are using all kinds of reasons to motivate witchcraft charges. There are land disputes, personal grievances, what have you, and most of the accused are confessing to witchcraft to save their lives. John and Elizabeth, however, refuse to confess because, well, they're innocent, and they actually reconcile. They rekindle their love for one another while discussing what it is they're going to do. So at one point, John is ready to confess, and he actually signs a confession. But when he realizes that this document will be posted for all to see, including his sons, he decides that his word is more important than his life, and he tearfully tears it up. And the film ends with him and the first two accused witches reciting the Lord's Prayer before they are hanged.
So in my background of studying theater, being a drama nerd, having 2 degrees in theater, I like to think I'm pretty familiar with the play. And actually, I've never seen the play be done. It's a really interesting play. I like it. But it's actually a really complex play in terms of the character dynamics and the relationship dynamics. It's a lot of stuff to pull off. And I feel like those dynamics are almost better in my head. And I can imagine everything being like sexy, but really subdued and a lot of tension and a lot of anger and a lot of hurt. So I feel like if I saw it, it would almost be shattered, which I did feel a little bit. So this was actually the first time I've ever seen the Crucible film. And there were a couple things I was really struck by in terms of what they changed. So they added the whole opening sequence with the girls dancing and running around. And to me, it kind of felt like this is stuff that we would do now at a sleepover. And this was kind of the fun aspect of the craft, was these girls playing and being a bit silly, but ultimately trying to dabble with something a little bit naughty. And that opening sequence is so important. And I really like that it was added because it immediately implicates Abigail in a much deeper level than Tituba, who is just kind of playing along with these girls and, you know, giving them what they want, which they really do seem to want to be doing and playing and expressing themselves.
Bijatimana lobatiko, bijatimana lobatiko.
Yeah, I thought that opening sequence was really interesting. I think going into this film, I was first of all expecting a very heavy drama. And while on the one hand it was, on the other hand it is plagued by some really abhorrent performances, which I'm sure we're going to get into shortly. But the opening sequence really circumvented my expectations because I was like, oh shit, you know, if these are the girls who are going to be tried for witchcraft and for getting up to no good, they kind of sort of were. In this very Puritan society, for them to be playing around in voodoo and actually physically getting naked and dancing in the fire was tremendously ballsy for them. And then I found out later how things were to unfold, but it really shocked me at first to see that all happening.
I love that they did that, and it's kind of just hinted at in the rest of the play. Another difference is that in the play, the priest only ever threatens to hit Tituba, but in the film, he, like, full-on beats her. And, you know, just even the threat of hitting another person is enough, and especially if you don't have the class standing that you would maybe want. That's a terrifying enough prospect in and of itself. But to actually see it and to actually see that fear and to see that turn that Tituba does where she then confesses and tells the whole story from her point of view is quite harrowing, and that actress, I thought, did such a great job.
How many times he bid me kill you, Mr. Parris?
Kill me?
Rise up, Tituba, cut that man, throw dust for him, tell me. I said, no, devil, I don't hate that man. Him say, Tituba, you work for me. I make you free. I give you pretty dress to wear. And I put you way up high in the air, and you go fly back home to Barbados.
I think so as well. I think her confession is, as I said, simultaneously a confession and an indictment. If you're going to burn me for this, well, I'm going to burn you guys back a little bit. And I thought that was really great.
It just played into the fact that she's a human being that has been taken from her home and is now serving this insane group of people who all believe in worshiping God and being so pure and so good to each other, you know, quote unquote. So I like that you see that dichotomy between her just living as herself and trying to engage these young girls and trying to make it fun. And then the amount she gets punished and how cruel Abigail is to her in those scenes is just, it's so hard to watch, as it should be. And I like that they made that a much harder scene than I think it would be in a play.
Right. And historically, for a black slave to be practicing voodoo is such a subversive act and such a controversial thing, you know, that slaves had it whipped out of them constantly in a genocidal effect to get them to reject their old culture. And so the fact that she was able to practice it and she kind of made it fun for the girls, yes, let's talk about the boys you like, yes, let's, you know, kill this chicken, whatever the fuck. They're having such a good time. They're having so much fun. It all seems so innocent. So it's really crushing to see it all come crashing down.
Did you hear one of the names that one of the girls mentions? Matthew Hopkins.
No way.
Check it again, but I'm like 99% positive.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah. She's gonna get some with Vincent Price.
I never met a monster I didn't like.
I think another kind of big thing that they added in were the court scenes. So those weren't included in the play. A lot of the play is done in very intimate scenes. They're very small scenes. And so when we have Mary and John Proctor and Judge Danforth coming at Mary and just being like, okay, what is your actual standpoint in this whole thing? We don't have the privilege of seeing in the play the bigger, larger courtroom where we get to see the whole community arriving to this thing and believing these girls as they point and accuse other women. It's actually great to kind of see that whole community and we get a better sense of the town as a whole, I think.
The progression of the hysteria is done very delicately, and it kind of starts with Abigail taking the lead, the girls following her lead. But I also was a bit critical of those scenes because it's difficult for people of our generation to imagine a world without the internet. Not only do we have the internet, we have it in our pockets at all times. But this is a world where not only did they not have internet, they didn't have anything. This is pilgrim times. They didn't have movies. When I'm watching these girls acting out in this hysteria, I'm just wondering where on earth they got that from.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to mention, especially at this point, that when Arthur Miller wrote this play, he pulled from real incidents that happened at Salem, Massachusetts during this whole thing. So John Proctor was a real person. Abigail was a real person. John Proctor was married to Elizabeth Proctor. There was a Judge Danforth. There was a Priest Hale. All of these people were real. One of the main things that Arthur Miller did to change it was that he made John Proctor a bit younger and looking a bit more like Daniel Day-Lewis, let's say. And Abigail was actually 11 years old when she accused.
Ew.
I know, but Arthur Miller was like, no, those two totally fucked, so let's make Abigail like 17, 18, and we'll be cool with it. There is so much unexplained thing, because as Andrea mentioned, they are so closed off to the rest of the world, to the rest of the influences. They're hearing things. There had been some witch trials in Boston previous to the Salem chaos and mania. So there was a kind of sense that witches are out there, we have to get them, we have to be good, we have to be pure, but not to this level. And I feel like it was one of those things like, I don't know if you guys were a kid and you fucked up and you told a lie and then you just kind of keep making the lie bigger and bigger and bigger and your parents within 2 minutes are like, okay, calm down. But in Salem, if you could latch onto the thing of that person's a witch and they hurt me and they're going to hurt you and they're evil and they're away from God, then it's a much bigger bag of worms than you could ever imagine. And it's something that spirals out from beyond your control very, very quickly. Adding fuel to the fire, we see Abigail, who is in love and, you know, wanting to get all handsy with John Proctor. So, you know, that young love is stoking that fire.
Lick it up, baby. Lick it up.
It's almost like what we understand as evidence that you need to provide in order to accuse someone of something was, in that case, just imagination. Because the shit that they pulled up to accuse these people, oh, she was in a different place at that time. She has an alibi. Well, her spirit came to see me and she turned into a bird. And oh, there's the devil right there. I can see him.
Ruth Putnam has informed me that there is a black man whispering in your ear at this very instant.
And Miller has been quite outspoken in his use of this as a metaphor, and obviously this was a big metaphor for McCarthyism, but pulling it back to Salem, Arthur Miller was reading through all of the court sessions and documents. He was really confused and kind of confounded by all the stuff that a witch would say have to do. So she'd have to make her mark in the Book of the Devil. And then he was like, whatever happened? Like, if that existed, what does that mean? What happens? Did anyone really care how that would all spiral out? But no one did. They just knew if you were accused and you could say all these things about a person. Yes, I saw them with the devil. I saw them make their mark in a book that he had. It meant that they were really a witch. And you couldn't disprove that because just as Andrea was saying, even the most ludicrous accusations, you could blow them out of proportion. And unless you could somehow completely prove that they were innocent, if you just said, oh, okay, I think there's maybe a misunderstanding. I think maybe those girls got a little out of it. I understand she's a thing for a guy. So you're probably not a witch. Super sorry about all this. High fives all around. That couldn't happen because if you did that, that would mean the devil was never there and then ultimately that the devil doesn't exist. So it becomes a much bigger problem where once you have that accusation, once you have that one thing that is said, it's a mark. It can't really ever be taken away.
And it's kind of interesting how nowadays we like to see ourselves as very rational and we've come a long way from the Salem witch trial days. But witness testimony, insofar as it's largely understood to be very fallible and very easily influenced by stuff you may have heard, things in your memory, the effects of trauma, witness testimony is still a really big deal in American law.
Yeah, and of course, for anyone who doesn't know, Arthur Miller wrote this play as kind of a response to the epidemic of McCarthyism, which was a kind of plague on American culture in the 1950s, where a senator named Joseph McCarthy actually went around just accusing people of being communists. And if you were a communist, you know, then that was really bad, but maybe you could name other communists. It was literally like the Salem witch trials, but with communists. And I think that's really interesting because Arthur Miller was able to really make that point between opposing something political and opposing something morally. So as soon as communists were identified as the other and bad, they became evil so quickly. And that's what we see a lot of hinted at in The Crucible. While it's not a horror film, it is that allegiance with the devil and the occult that is really terrifying.
What's also terrifying is how relevant the themes remain today. And McCarthyism, I'd say the new McCarthyism of our era has to be terrorism. The fingers pointed toward anything that's actually racially progressive can be construed as terrorism, because terrorism is such a great excuse to indulge in these racist fantasies. So another thing that's really interesting from a sociological standpoint of McCarthyism is that this practice of making allegations without proper regard of evidence, and that is the really general definition of McCarthyism, even though Alex just situated it as the second Red Scare, the campaign to spread fear among Americans against communist spies living among them. The targets of McCarthyism at that time were government employees, educators, you know, the usual suspects, but also entertainers, which is a really interesting acknowledgement of the power of Hollywood over the American psyche. And for someone like me, a sociologist who's interested in cultural production, I've always pointed to Hollywood as something that keeps the capitalist machine going, that keeps patriarchy going, these little themes that we pick up. But I feel like McCarthyism was one movement that really cemented and validated the influence of Hollywood. And there were lots of artists who were blacklisted at that time. And being blacklisted for being a commie or an anti-American sympathizer was a really big deal. It ruined people's careers. It ruined people's lives. And some common names associated with that blacklist are Leonard Bernstein, the famous composer, Orson Welles, Burgess Meredith. These are all people who came head to head with it. Vincent Price as well.
Well, and I think today, like, obviously, we all have a love of horror, and I think Andrea and I kind of continue to find a lot of stuff, and we continue to do this podcast because so much of horror is actually quite subversive when you look at it in contradistinction to everything else that's going on in our world. So, I mean, my God, if Joseph McCarthy was still making accusations today, we'd be, like, next on the list, if we were in the States, but we're not. We're in Canada. We're in socialist paradise.
As the Socialist Party faded from the U.S. political scene, some of the farmers who had embraced its ideals would take their politics north, to Canada.
So another thing I found interesting about this film, watching it and then thinking about it after the fact, is the characterization of gender is actually kind of interesting. These girls realize such power. I think that's a big part of what compels them to continue as the lie just snowballs. It's like, holy shit, I've got people's lives in my hand. And that's something that not a lot of human beings get, much less women. If you look at women today, women can't even claim to being raped without being run over the coals and interrogated and essentially prosecuted for, have you ever had sex? Have you ever enjoyed sex? Did you ever dress like you might like sex? Stuff like that, I think, is really interestingly explored in The Crucible, how these girls get that whiff of power and just get addicted to it and can't seem to stop rolling with it. Now, it irritates me a little bit that the nexus of morality mostly lies in the character of John Proctor. His wife, Elizabeth, is a very, very pious person who has absolutely no wrongdoing, but at the same time, a lot of the moral and emotional merit tends to go to John for his big decree of, I say God is dead, and his big, I don't want my name attached to this confession. And something I read about The Crucible was that The Crucible was written at a time when Arthur Miller's marriage to Marilyn Monroe was going under, and Arthur Miller was reconciling with himself what might have happened, and as such, he wrote John Proctor with this fallibility, as he was not perfect, and it plagued their marriage throughout, and she couldn't quite forgive him, but he was still a very, very good man. Wasn't he such a good man?
He's such a good man.
Not so much with the dental hygiene toward the end, but overall a very, very good man. Now, even the title, The Crucible, if you look at what a crucible is, there were a couple of working titles for the play and then a couple of working titles for the film, but a crucible is a container for things that are subject to very high temperature, which again expands to everything happening in this film. These characters who are each more or less good people exposed to the heat of the situation and how they can respond and their lack of power when faced with the heat of the situation.
And I think that's kind of ultimately the message of The Crucible is, who are we when our backs are against the wall? Who do we decide to be? Who do we choose to be? And why do we choose that? And, you know, I think John Proctor, in his name and his family name and doing it for his sons, John Proctor will eschew so many things. He will eschew his life, his family, but he will not give up his name. And that is the one thing that will last. Andrew and I can go on to do, you know, whatever we want. We could have families, we could have kids, we could retire to the country. But ultimately, this podcast and our writing that we are doing, that will outlast us in terms of a memory and in terms of a record of us. So it's that idea of a name, and especially in whatever you do, it's going to impact and it's going to stay with you. And that's going to be a bigger part of you than your physical essence. So I thought it was really interesting that rather than succumb and take that way out, Miller posits that the more noble thing, the deeper thing to do is to accept the sacrifice. And, you know, in the final moments of the film before they're hanged, when they're reciting the Lord's Prayer, ultimately that's a huge fuck you to the townspeople, because if you're a witch, you can't say the word of God. And they're literally in front of them saying the Lord's Prayer until they are hung.
Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, in earth as it is in heaven.
Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive them that trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
That's right, and that's another great example of how this movie stands in contradistinction to the other movies that we talked about dealing with witchcraft, is this movie contains no indictment of the Catholic Church. There is no pro-Christian, anti-pagan message to be found. This is not actually a movie about witches. This is a movie about scapegoating and witch hunting.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you see that in some of the scenes in John Proctor's home where they are quizzing John Proctor about whether or not he's a good Christian, whether he can name all the commandments.
Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods, nor make unto thee any graven image. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord in vain. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Thou shalt honor thy father and mother. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven...
Said that twice.
I know.
And he's not saying he's a bad Christian. I think he's trying to be a good Christian. He just doesn't go to church every single day. He doesn't do everything by the book. It doesn't mean that he doesn't love quote-unquote God or is trying to live a good life and trying to live within the community and contribute to the community. He's just not doing it to that level. And I think it becomes a really scary thing when you see someone who ultimately, like us, like we're not going to do the best thing every moment of every day, but I think we're all trying. And when you see someone get punished just for trying out of their own psyche and mentality, that's a hard thing. And I think it creates a lot of empathy for that character. So to wrap up our discussion of Arthur Miller's The Crucible, I actually wanted to end with a quote from Miller. And this is in an article he wrote for The New Yorker while they were filming the version of The Crucible for the screen. And this quote is, "But of course, actions are as irrelevant during cultural and religious wars as they are in nightmares." Which takes us to Dario Argento's 1980 film, Inferno.
I do not know what price I shall have to pay for breaking what we alchemists call silentium. Experiences of our colleagues should warn us not to upset laymen by imposing our knowledge upon them.
The book!
There are mysterious parts in that book, but the only true mystery is that our very lives are governed by dead people.
Beginning, there were three mothers, the same as there were three fates and three furies. Man has always mistakenly called them by one terrifying name.
Oh.
afraid. I'm afraid to be left alone.
My sister. Where is my sister?
It's as if I were constantly being watched. And at times, I think I actually feel a presence, as if someone were in the room with me.
Who lives in this damned house?
Someone who is waiting.
But who?
You are being watched.
So Inferno is a thematic sequel to Suspiria and the second film in the Three Mothers trilogy, which of course starts with Suspiria, continues with Inferno, and then wraps up with the 2007 film Mother of Tears. So in Inferno, there's a young woman named Rose. She is a poet living in New York City, and as the film opens, she's reading a book called The Three Mothers by an architect and writer named Varelli. And this book is about three evil, powerful witches, or mothers, who control the world via their different locations where they all have homes. So the first one is in Freiburg, Germany, which was the story of Suspiria. And then the second homes are in Rome and New York City. Rose thinks she actually may be living in one of these homes because her building, there's a strange smell, things are weird. There's something very uneasy about this whole building. And so in the opening of the film, she actually ventures down into a cellar, which is one of the clues of how to find one of these three mothers, to see if she can actually figure this out. She has a very existential, dreamlike sequence where she dives through water and vaguely emerges and escapes a threat. And while she escapes, there is a sense that the evil presence is onto her and is going to start following her. That same night, she writes a letter to her brother Mark, who's studying music in Rome. So Rose's letter actually seems to be tainted and causes multiple deaths when it reaches Rome, actually skipping Mark, who doesn't really get to the letter until the very end of their time in Rome. Mark arrives in New York City to go find his sister and, you know, make sure she's okay, only to find that she's gone missing. He stays in her building. He meets all these strange characters that live in this building who are all decrepit, and it's a very strange, very Argento-like building. Finally, after more deaths in New York City that center around this building, he comes face to face with Varelli, the writer of this book, who had been masquerading as Professor Arnold in the building. Now, Varelli seems to be guardian or servant to the mother of this building, and Varelli actually tries to attack and dope Mark. However, in the struggle, it is Varelli who is actually subdued and dies. Mark then goes into the next room where he meets the Mother of Darkness, who is the supposed youngest and cruelest of these three mothers. In a very strange scene that's very, very artificial and kind of ham-fisted, a fire rages around them, which had started earlier. And as the fire rages, the building begins to crumble, which, much like Susie Banyan in Suspiria, actually allows Mark to escape the building and flee the wreckage while the building actually crumbles down on the mother. If that made any sense, God bless you all.
If you've seen the film, you'll know that that synopsis made about as much sense of it as it possibly could. I found this film a struggle to get through. I've always struggled a little bit with Argento and always struggled a bit with Gialli. I feel like a bit of a turncoat because I am Italian. But when it comes to giallo, we haven't talked about giallo a whole lot before, but it is a very trope-filled horror subgenre that has a very specific checklist that you have to tick off in order for it to qualify. And this film does qualify. It's got the black-gloved killer. It's got the very strong sensory experience. It's got the light. It's got the music, which is occasionally really jarring. It's got these long, drawn-out deaths. And I don't know. It's just not my thing.
See, I actually really liked it, despite how disjointed my synopsis maybe sounded. It couldn't do justice to all the crazy deaths and strange sequences within the film. Actually, it was interesting going back and listening to our first Witches episode. Andrea actually makes mention of Suspiria and the fact that we probably will never talk about it because it is so visual. I actually think Inferno might be, if not just as visual, possibly more visual and a bit more refined than Suspiria. I think it is much more existential. I think it really embraces that nightmarish dream quality. And for me, I actually found it quite harrowing and strange, but also very hypnotic to watch. And I wonder if this was like in the dreams and the minds of, you know, the people who thought witches were real while they were being terrorized in, you know, the 17th century as things were raging around them and they saw spirits and specters and other people were claiming that those things were real. This did feel like that fevered dream that would come from that psyche.
I did definitely like the idea of this haunted letter, the fact that this was an idea that those who pursued it met with a quick or not so quick demise. Those who investigated it and tried to learn more got what was coming to them. I felt like it kind of meandered into other areas. The whole subplot of the man who owned the antique store who was killing cats. My God, when I was watching that, all I could think of was so many cats were hurt in the making of this film. There's no way cats were not hurt in the making of this film. I think cats and people were hurt. I think they threw cats on people to watch them both get hurt.
Well, it should be noted, I believe it was Mario Bava who worked extensively on this film alongside Argento, helping set up certain scenes and basically, from what I've read, co-directing this film alongside him. And I believe it was Mario Bava who said that he actually couldn't be around cats after filming this because they were working with a lot of cats and it was just really intense and they were all like fidgety and angry. So he couldn't really be in a room with them after.
Understandable. Now, Mario Bava was a huge influence on Dario Argento. Bava, if you're not familiar, was the director of Black Sunday. He's a really big deal within genre horror film, especially the Italian genre horror film. Now, this film met with a lot of trouble in distribution, which is suspected for the film's lack of success, which to me is just kind of like a, are you sure it's not because it's kind of really boring? But the
it's
film.
It's not boring.
It had a very limited release in the U.S., and it's possible that American audiences just simply weren't quite ready for it. I think Suspiria was celebrated in America for being so different, and yet it had kind of a fairly conventional plot line that people were able to follow along while still appreciating the tremendous color, the beautiful architecture, and the music and stuff like that, whereas Inferno was maybe a bit more artsy and a little bit more dense.
Yeah, and I think if, you know, you responded to that visual aspect in Suspiria, then certain parts of Inferno will definitely speak to you. Not all of it, possibly, but I think it is still a worthwhile film. I like what it does and how it really just is. It's a spiritual sequel, I think, to Suspiria, and this is how a lot of people describe it. I don't know if you can say it's a direct sequel. I really feel like Suspiria just kind of mentioned the three mothers, Helena Marcos. It all feels a little bit touch and go, like they were doing it as they were going, but I personally find the films that have to go back, reinvent, make sense of mythology, I find those quite interesting. And maybe, as you might have heard in our last episode, that's actually kind of why I like Paranormal Activity 3 so much. I like when you actually have to see filmmakers work a little bit to make sense of things they've set up in previous films. Now, one of the things that Suspiria had that I think a lot of people latched on to, and even though it does have a plot, I would say it's a pretty threadbare plot. It's pretty simple, but it very much mimics a fairy tale. Now, I actually thought, you know, the second that Mark goes behind the curtain, so to speak, and meets Varelli or whatever form Varelli's in, it just reminded me, it was like the penny dropped in my mind, and I was like, oh, it's like the Wizard of Oz. Mark is kind of on this journey where he meets people. Unfortunately, all those people die. And he pulls back a curtain, and this kind of strange, mad world that he has been existing in is just seemingly controlled by this old man in a wheelchair who can't really speak. It's just a small little man behind a curtain. It's not the great and powerful Oz. It's not this big, fearsome or fearful Varelli who created these homes for the three mothers. It's a servant and a slave who's just trying to protect his master.
And further to the servant and slave metaphor is the fact that when he actually meets the head witch, she is posing as Varelli's nurse. She's pushing him around in the wheelchair, and she's in her little uniform, and they have a really strange exchange in the elevator where she's kind of like, oh, he's trying to speak to you. Isn't that adorable? So you're a what?
And you, what do you do?
Oh, I'm a student. Musicology.
Oh, wonderful. A professor. Toxicology. We know two other young men.
No, it's not toxicology, musicology. It's got nothing to do with medicine.
What is it, then?
The study of music.
Oh, yes. Your sister's involved in rather strange work, too.
And then to find out later that he is actually her puppet and her slave, Mark is able to dispatch with Varelli pretty easily. Spoiler alert, he strangles himself on his own vocal synthesizer thing that allows him to speak. But I found it, frankly, a little bit disappointing that this great and powerful Oz that does emerge and it becomes the physical manifestation of death. She suddenly looks like this Grim Reaper-type person, and then just to be crushed in the wreckage of the building that housed all her power.
Well, that's actually one of my biggest problems with Suspiria, and I think Argento falls prey to the same thing, is that Helena Marcos, the mother in Suspiria, it's like Susie just stabs her and runs away, and that's the end of it. You know, and I think when you have a whole film, when you have 80 or 90 minutes building up to this figure that is, you know, in this film, it's the youngest and she's the most cruel, it's so easy to defeat her. That becomes a bit problematic for me. But I was thinking quite a bit because a lot of reviews I read of this film mark that point when, you know, she's a beautiful, attractive woman as she appears and she talks to him for a bit and then makes the exclamation that she is death.
Tell me who you are!
The three mothers. Haven't you understood? Mater Tenebrarum. Mater Lacrimarum. Mater Suspiriorum. But men call us by a single name. A name which strikes fear into everyone's heart. They call us... Death! Death!
And then she kind of appears as like, and people have said this, like a Halloween costume version of death. It's like almost like a rubber mask and a little cloak. And it's just so strange for how beautifully this film is made, how beautifully it's shot, all the art direction, all the like little touches throughout the whole film. Whether you like the film as a whole or not, I think you can't discount the thought and the touches that go into this film. But it actually reminded me a lot of something called epic theater. And this was a type of theater that emerged in Germany under the ideas of Bertolt Brecht. Epic theater was really about showing representation and not showing reality. Brecht thought that by people connecting to something emotionally through a story, that they were actually sitting back in it. By showing artifice, by showing the nuts and bolts of how everything is done, by making everything very staged, the audience wouldn't be able to connect with it emotionally. They would be able to connect with it on a more intellectual level. So I thought that played quite heavily into this final scene with the Mother of Darkness. And I thought it was great because not only do we have this silly, almost flimsy costume encompassing this great and powerful witch, but there are literal smoke and mirrors around her. It is so in your face, the artifice of this thing. And I think he's trying to show that in a lot of ways, we are just mirroring a representation that doesn't exist and maybe never existed for a witch or for our idea of a witch.
It's one of those films that's more about the journey and about the ending. And I think as Western audiences, we've been conditioned to expect this big climax, this big showdown. Everything is building toward this good and evil that's happening. We've been conditioned that way through TV, through cinema, through video games even. Like, this is the big boss, this is the big bad.
And I think in Inferno, it's just a sense that none of these things ever really existed. I mean, you know, she says, I'm not a magician. And for me, the way I read it is that that evil permeates those buildings. It permeates that life. It permeates everything it touches. It's not just a single figure. It's something much deeper and older and darker.
That's right. It's something that's living in these buildings, and it's a mystery that was able to be uncovered, presumably years later. They made it seem like it's a very ancient evil that's built into the very bones of this architecture in these very old cities.
And I love that each of these films plays with that history. So you have Freiburg, Germany, this kind of small town in Germany in Suspiria. And then New York, which is in, of course, the United States, which is much like Canada, a very young country in the greater context of the world. So it's interesting that these three witches have spread out through these different things and are controlling matters and are controlling things. And I personally believe, maybe it's because of my last name, but like in The Wizard of Oz, I never believed the Wicked Witch of the West was just done because water got thrown on her. Evil doesn't die that easily. It stays. It is kind of omnipresent. And I was thinking, actually, when I listened back to our witches episode, I think I made a comment, actually, that was like, you know, with the hammer of witches and the interrogation of women, and, you know, we just don't do that anymore. And gosh darn it, I was so young and naive a year ago. And, you know, the second, you know, you start looking at the Crucible and you look at moral panics, you look at the evil that is done in this world. And, you know, I think Andrea has made this point in older episodes of ours that we are just more accustomed to the evil around us. So I like that these people exist in this dream world where they can meet a big, bad, evil thing and it just collapses. But I think the evil stays. In keeping with this idea of evil and witches and things like that, which we are wont to do on this episode, I like that they are referred to as the Three Mothers. So this comes from Thomas de Quincey's book, Suspiria de Profundis, where he talks about the three fates, the three graces, and Argento, as he was reading it, I guess, thought, well, there should be some version of evil. So he developed the kind of idea of Three Mothers in tandem with some other writings and things like that. And I like so much that they are called the Three Mothers because to be a mother, you have to have a child. And I always wonder what these children are. And for me, I actually think it's the protagonists in these films. So you have Susie, who's a young dancer, going to Germany and discovering herself and discovering, you know, being on her own for the first time. In this film, I think it's, you know, Rose or Mark who are really asserting themselves and kind of coming into their own through the discovery of this book and of these witches.
The spoken intro to the film, the narration of the book, The Three Mothers, that Rose is looking at, also kind of conflates the three mothers with, well, they're also three sisters, which I think was an effort to bring them together in a youthful camaraderie type thing. But also, when they mention the mothers, it is in that they are able to create and they are able to reproduce.
Well, and also going to the fact of, I did make a little bit of this point in our last witches episode, but when you look at something like Shakespeare's Macbeth, which is one of the most famous and influential versions of a witch, they are the three sisters or the three weird sisters. There is that sense of, again, as we talked about in that episode, of needing a threesome, of needing that beginning, middle, end, you know, the three fates, three graces.
Yeah, the Holy Trinity, the trifecta, it comes up a lot, especially with respect to women.
I actually thought it was really interesting in this film, and I actually had to go back and rewatch a couple of things, and I read a few things that also pointed to this as well. But in the film, and we've mentioned how beautiful it is visually and stylistically, horror loves to really exacerbate the death of women. They like to spend a bit more time on it. A guy or a boyfriend in a horror film or a slasher can die really quickly, but the women, you're going to spend more time on. And in Inferno, when the deaths of the women happen, that's when you get the kind of crazy lights and the darkness and the light and the blue and the red and the yellow. And I think that's what works so well in this film is where for the first half you have Rose's experience of the building, which is a very terrifying, almost M.C. Escher-like building where things go into other things and you're descending and ascending at the same time. It's very hard to get a grip on where you are in this building. And then the second Mark shows up, it's just this kind of plain, ugly old building with, like, weird neighbors in it. So I like that it plays into that sense of women are somehow more in tune with the supernatural because we're super sensitive.
Yeah, I picked up on that a lot in this film as well. I even picked up on that in the very first scene where Rose is talking to the antique dealer. He talks over her a couple of times. He cuts her off like, oh, you're interested in this. Well, you don't know what you're talking about. Well, never mind. I have to close now. Well, just go away. Then later, when we have a young woman who encounters a young man in the elevator and is like, you know what? I am frightened. I can't say exactly what it is because it's not a rational, real fear. But would you come over to my place because I'm frightened of being alone? And he's all like, oh, I don't believe in that stuff.
Have you ever heard of the Three Sisters?
You mean those black singers?
No. I'm talking about mythology. the Trident.
Hold on. If you're talking about spooks and stuff, I don't believe in any of that.
How can you be so sure?
I don't believe in such things, that's all. And without any philosophical discussion.
And what do you believe in?
In whatever I can see and touch.
He represents rationality and science, and I don't believe in that kind of things. Whereas the women in this film are the nexus for emotion and most predominantly fear, but the fear is justified. So if anything, the message here is to be able to listen to your fear and listen to that feminine side and embrace it.
Yeah, and I was thinking again that it's very much a young woman's experience of living in a city, in a big bad city all by herself. There's a real tactile sense of having to be careful around every corner, and that the men are just kind of wandering in and out of scenes. They meet a witch, the building falls on a witch, whatever, bye. But for a woman, it's quite harrowing, and I like that kind of sensory experience that it gives of it. So obviously, this film has a recognition of being a giallo film, and I don't think that's wrong, but I actually read a review which qualified it as a gothic fantasy masquerading as a giallo, and I actually really like that. That's when the wheels really started turning for me. So, you know, gothic fantasy or horror, whatever, that really comes from, you know, two very seminal books being Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and Bram Stoker's Dracula, and there's a lot of stuff in between that can fall into that. So there were a couple things that really jumped out at me if you look at the qualities of a gothic horror, and that is that it's more intended to elicit shock and reaction rather than to educate or be a moral compass to anything. And I think in Inferno you see a lot of shock and awe in the deaths, in the set design, in the production design. It's very much a very visceral experience. Another big thing about gothic horror is that it really lives and dies by its duality, and that's the duality of characters, their nature, human nature, and also of setting. And I really like that Inferno plays into that, and it's most telling with Varelli and the Mother of Darkness, who masquerade as a professor and their nurse. So we're seeing a kind of low servant to a high master, and that completely flipping on its head in the end. And there is a very literal descension, as you have to descend into the cellar, as Rose does, as Mark does, where they have to make sense of a world. And, you know, it's a very literal metaphor where they are walking down to the depths of hell to confront the big monster or the big bad. So I think that goes back into the Brechtian theme of epic theater. We are literally watching people descend to meet this monster, and they have to meet them at their level. And the fact that a monster will never be who you think it is. It's playing on that, you know, last turn, that last sting of a tail that will get you. And I dig that Inferno does it with such balls. And Dario Argento has called Inferno his most pure and sincere film. And I think you see that because he's not masquerading behind too much. He's really enjoying the production design and the direction of it and just giving us kind of a bare-bones story where we can explore our fears. And I really like how that's played out in this film.
I guess I'm just a bit too cerebral, I guess. This is something that I've come into with a lot of art house films, with a lot of art house horror films. You know, I watched this and I was very impatient with it. You might have heard me criticize Alex for turning a movie off halfway through because I'm like, no, you have to watch the whole thing to be able to criticize it fully. But she's more of the opinion that if I'm not getting anything out of this, I'm just going to turn it off. Whereas when it came to Inferno, I was just kind of like, I wonder what my phone's doing. Holy shit, look at that hangnail. I was so easily distracted. And it really hurt my experience of it. And furthermore, I felt like I'm grasping at straws to try and take something from Inferno that informs our discussion here, as we talked about The Witchfinder General, which I thought was such an interesting film because it looked at witchcraft totally out of context of witches and paganism and women, which we talked about in the first episode. We talked about The Crucible, which again wasn't about paganism and it wasn't about womanhood. It was about scapegoating and McCarthyism and the power of the masses to rally and crucify people over nothing.
And I think, as I said before, I think Inferno is the fever dream of anyone who ever believed in those witches or the fact that witches could hurt them. It is so conflated. It is so big. It is so ridiculous in so many ways. And I kind of felt like it was a tunnel vision into that terrifying old world feeling of what a witch was and how much power a witch could yield. So if you remember from our first Witches episode, one of the things I pointed out was that it was so exciting last summer because the big Disney offering was the film Maleficent. And while it's not a big summer offering this year, it is coming out in October. And I thought it was so interesting that we're going from something like Maleficent, which is a revisioning, a retelling of an evil witch story, to a film starring Vin Diesel called The Last Witch Hunter. But it's a very testosterone-fueled film.
Yeah, it definitely looks that way. I saw the trailer, and it appears to be a very superhero-stylized Vin Diesel who is going to go against these witches. They appear to be very sexy witches and very seductive witches, and they're going to be the kind of witches that get you with their seductive wiles. And, of course, they want Vin Diesel because it doesn't get much more alpha male than Vin Diesel, does it? So they're going to seduce him, but he's going to be like, no, bitch, and he's going to be, like, shooting them left and right. That's what it looks like.
Yeah. But it also stars like Michael Caine and Elijah Wood, so I don't know what to make of this film. We'll probably eventually see it, but it's interesting to me that, you know, we did one year where we focused on the inner turmoil of a witch and the power that comes with that, and then Maleficent came out, and now we're looking at the broader spectrum of witchcraft, and we see a Lock and Load, Let's Blow Up Some Fucking Witches film coming out.
That's right. We've shifted the focus from the witch to the witch hunter, which is a really interesting contradistinction, especially the way we've problematized the figure of the witch. Is she something to be feared and reviled, or is she something to be respected and old-worldly and wise?
And I think, if anything, one of the things we can pull from both of these episodes and the conclusion I've come to is that, ultimately, the figure of a witch is a tragic figure. And it's tragic in this episode through the historical context of, you know, they were persecuted, they were maligned, they were most likely, and I truly believe, all innocent. They were just maybe a bit weird outside of the social norms, and that was their fault. That was their tragic flaw that led to their deaths. And in our first episode, we kind of explored the problem with taking on that power and how there wasn't room for strong or interesting women to accept that power within our culture, and that it's still hard for that to happen. There is no space for that. We aren't given the space to accept differences and accept change.
And then in this episode, we expanded the discussion to show how even outside the figure of the actual witch, the social context around witches, aka witch hunting and witch trials and scapegoating and McCarthyism, the legacy of the witch carries through because it's a trope that we all understand and it still applies today to a variety of things that we fear.
Yeah, and it exists all around us. I mean, I was in Salem just this last year, and it is kind of this commercial hotbed for witchcraft. And in some ways, it's really incredible because a lot of Wiccans move there and reclaim the area and the space for a really positive way to express themselves, which is fantastic. And there's a lot of historical realism going on in a lot of historical plays and tons of museums, and you can really go search this out. However, it's also a very commercial entity. So for me, it was really fun to go to and experience, and I want to go back eventually. But it's not as pure. It's become a little industry unto itself. And I don't know how much it all means anymore. I don't know if we've gotten further away from it or we're getting closer to it, frankly.
Well, that's kind of the great thing that we've uncovered in this episode, is that we can see the shadow of witchcraft manifested in so many other areas of contemporary social life, as we still see McCarthyism played out within terrorism. We still see that within feminism a lot. At the time that we're recording this, Joss Whedon has just been supposedly chased off Twitter by feminists, and it's something that I've been following kind of peripherally, because I was only aware of it after the fact, and I was like, what the fuck is going on? Why are feminists being blamed for chasing Joss Whedon anywhere? If anyone is a feminist god in Hollywood right now, it's Joss Whedon, so what the hell is happening? And it just goes to show you the current social climate, the power afforded to people on social media and Twitter, and being able to speak directly to people and criticize them for their work, and not criticize their work, but criticize them to the point that they are being threatened with violence and that they don't want to participate in social media, which is something that they do to connect with their fans, is actually a really fucked up thing. And it's, again, just kind of the specter of witchcraft manifesting itself today.
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, no matter how far you get away from it, you're going to have that mark. Joss Whedon will have some kind of, oh, that one time the feminists chased him off the internet. And no matter what happens, no matter how far you get, if you have like an infraction on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, as a lot of us have a presence on there, it's going to follow you. It will come up in a Google search. If you're applying for a job, it'll show up. So we are all kind of living in this strange new world, and I don't know if it's very brave, but we're in a new world, and I think we're all trying to make sense of it.
So that's part two of our witchcraft episode. I think I would have said at the end of part one that we did the topic to death, but today I can conclusively say that I do not have anything more to say about witchcraft.
Yeah, I think it would take something kind of big for us to revisit the topic, but I loved coming back to it. Maybe we'll just do another episode on the craft. Who knows?
We definitely loved the big response that that episode got. It's still probably one of our most downloaded and listened to episodes, so we love that that conversation is still going on. And we love that our Facebook page has recently gotten a whole lot more likes, and a lot of people are engaging with us and engaging with each other on our Facebook, which means a lot to us.
For next month, we want to examine how horror can get big, how it can get really big, how it can be a blockbuster. So heading into summer, we are now in heady blockbuster season. There is a new multi-million, multi-hundred-thousand-million-dollar film coming out every week that is going to supposedly blow the doors off of everyone's mind. So we want to, in June, examine the idea of the horror blockbuster.
Right, and to that end, we are going to be looking at two horror blockbusters that were big, huge deals in the summer, and I think sometimes the big blockbusters get overlooked. I think when we're looking for really pithy horror analytical stuff, we tend to look at the small fries. We tend to look at The Wicker Man that gets glossed over. We tend to look at Inferno that people love and maybe don't talk about quite enough.
So for this episode, we're going to be talking about two films. And the first one is Jan de Bont's 1999 remake of The Haunting.
And the second is the movie adaptation of Max Brooks' World War Z. So that's your homework until next episode, guys. So until then,
office hours are closed.